So Halloween was yesterday, and I'm sure many of you were out with your kids trick-or-treating. You know, I was thinking about it, and I'm not really sure how this whole trick-or-treat thing got started, but it's really just treating now, isn't it? I mean, when was the last time that you went trick-or-treating and ended up getting tricked? As a kid, trick-or-treating is great because you basically wander around and just get treats in exchange for nothing. But very few things in life are like that, and real estate is no exception. It can be easy to get tricked in real estate, or at least to fail to get treats. There are lots of ways to lose money, and many physicians discover that to their detriment. But that's why I'm excited about today's guest. He's a physician turned real estate mogul, and he's going to show us how to make money on real estate without losing everything. So buckle up, because this is going to be even better than that Halloween candy you're munching on. Let's kick it. It's feeling so good right now.
Welcome to the Scope of Practice podcast, where we help busy healthcare professionals learn to manage their businesses successfully and master their personal finances. Now, here's your host, Dr. Brent Lacey.
Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for joining me for the Scope of Practice podcast, where you can get the knowledge and resources you need to grow your leadership skills, your business, and your personal finances. Welcome to episode 83. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, please be sure to go ahead and hit that subscribe button right now. And then don't forget, hit the button at the top of the podcast player that'll turn on the automatic downloads. That way you can listen to these episodes anytime, anywhere, even if you're deep, deep within the hospital where you don't get good service. Also, in case you missed the last couple of weeks, this podcast is now eligible for CME credits, and it's free. Every new podcast episode is now eligible for AMA Category 1 CME credits. Just click the link in the podcast description or go to www.thescopeofpractice.com/podcastCME to download your CME credits for free. Hey guys, listen, I am super excited about this. We are just 2 weeks away from the start of the free online summit I'm hosting on November 15th through 17th called Marriage and Money MD. It's a free 3-day online event that will give physician families the tools, resources, and encouragement they need to strengthen their marriage and build wealth so that they can have the happy family and financial independence they deserve. Just go to marriageandmoneymd.com or click the link in the podcast description to sign up for free. It's completely free to sign up, so sign up today. And listen, even if you can't attend live, sign up anyway and you'll get access to the replays of the talks for the rest of the week. The conference is also eligible for up to 21 Category 1 CME credits, so don't miss out on getting to knock out all of your CME for the year in one event. Also, if you want to get access to the 10-plus hours of bonus content from our speakers, plus exclusive access to join the live Q&A sessions at the end of each night with our speakers, and lots more bonus content besides, you can upgrade to an all-access VIP pass for just $99. Ticket prices go up to $149 once the conference starts, so upgrade today. Take advantage of those savings. Also, since the summit is eligible for CME credits, you can also use your continuing education funds through your employer to pay for it. Again, the summit is free to attend, so sign up today at www.marriageandmoneymd.com. My guest today is Dr. Sunil Saxena. Dr. Saxena is an emergency medicine doctor and lifelong entrepreneur. He has started 6 successful companies, mostly focused on real estate and real estate development. He has been involved in construction, remodeling, development, and sales, and he's completed over 100 projects, including small rehabs to larger multi-unit projects. He retired from full-time clinical practice to take on the real estate world, and I am excited that he's here today to share his tips and tricks for how to take our real estate game to the next level. So here is my conversation with Dr. Sunil Saxena. Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for joining me this week to welcome my guest on the Scope of Practice podcast. This is the co-founder of Hyperfast Development, a real estate investment company, Dr. Sunil Saxena. Dr. Saxena, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. Excited to be here and looking forward to talking a little bit about it, real estate investments.
Well, this is going to be great. We haven't actually had a chance to talk about real estate investments in quite some time. I mean, we've talked a little bit about buying a house with Ryan Inman about 3 or 4 months ago, and we talked about short-term rentals last summer, but it's been close on to a year since I had an episode where we talked really seriously about real estate investments. And I know that's something that a lot of docs are really interested in, and even if they're not ready to start investing, they want it to be part of their, you know, big time investment strategy in the future, at least. And so there's a lot of interest on this subject. But one of the things that I always like to hear from folks that have interesting stories, which really is most of my guests, is just hear a little bit about your personal story. And in your case, you started out as emergency medicine. You did emergency medicine for what, 8 years, and then went into this full time. So how do you go from full time emergency medicine to full time real estate investment?
Yeah. We can probably do the whole episode just on that question if you really want, but, I graduated really young from medical school. I was in a 6-year program. So I was 23 when I graduated medical school. I had the MD at 23. I actually started in orthopedic surgery, believe it or not, did a year of that, really didn't like surgery at all. And then transitioned over to emergency medicine. It's difficult because, you know, as a physician, you make good money. You know, I was making about $200,000-$250,000 a year, and to replace that salary takes a while. But I just knew I'm an entrepreneur at heart. Medicine wasn't my long-term future. I knew that, but it was a tough transition, but was able to do it. Just decided to do it one day and kept moving forward. But it took me about 8 years. You had to really, transition out of it full time.
Do you feel like people need to be entrepreneurial minded in order to take real estate investment seriously? Or is that just something that was interesting to you and sort of led you down the path of creating this company?
No, actually, yeah. I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I've actually done a ton of other businesses as well. I just keep going back to real estate because I think it's the best of anything I've ever done. I don't think you have to be entrepreneurial. I feel like everybody should be involved with real estate in some form or fashion. So even if you have a day job as a physician and that's what you love doing and, that's what you want to do for the rest of your life, I still feel to really build wealth, you still should be involved with real estate in some form or fashion, whether it's completely passive, like investing with us in our fund, or you can do it more actively, like I did, where I left medicine and this is all I do. This is all I've done since 2009, full time.
Well, so we're going to definitely break some things down today, because I know one of the things that prevents people from really doing anything is going to be some series of limiting beliefs. And I think that there's a lot of misconceptions out there from among physicians and really people in general that the idea of real estate investing is unattainable or is unnecessarily complicated or is only for the uber, uber wealthy. But as I hope we'll discuss today, there's a lot of opportunities for people that at really all stages. So let's start from the beginning then. So we've got a lot of folks that are listening that are either in training or fairly early in their career. A lot of folks are still working on paying off student loans, but they're looking to the future and they're thinking, okay, well, I don't have $1 million to invest in a big real estate venture right now, but I want to get started on something. So when you've got someone who's first getting started, what are some options that people can consider?
Yeah, I think the first thing you have to think is, again, are you looking to kind of, do this full time as completely active like I do? Or, it's either, are you totally going to be, completely passive, completely active, or somewhere in the middle? That's really the first decision you got to make. Again, if you want to be completely passive, one of the nice things is there are a lot of real estate funds, including ours, that you can invest in. For example, we pay a 15% annualized preferred return, which these type of funds weren't available to the general public. Even I think it was like 2016, 17 when the SEC changed the rules where we could, generally solicit funds like that. Before it was kind of, like you said, kept for the uber wealthy and the rich and all that kind of stuff. So they're much more available. If you look online, you'll see a lot of people doing this, including us. So I think you can earn a lot better return and be involved with a lot better investments just as a non-insider, if that makes sense. So that's one thing you can consider. If you want to be really active, you just start educating yourself and start, deciding your path of how you want to do it. Or you can be somewhere in the middle. You can buy a few properties, hold them for the long term, build that long-term wealth. There's still work involved. That's the thing. So if you're going to be kind of in that middle zone, it's not like 100% where it's just passive. You have to still have some active involvement with the properties in the project.
So when people are first getting started, there's so many different things that they can consider. And what I'd be curious to know is, someone who's been doing this for a really long time, are there certain things that really should not be considered first line investor choices for someone who's first getting started? Like, should we be thinking about starting with single family rentals, or should we be thinking more about looking into more of the diversified funds, or should we be thinking more about looking for individual commercial real estate deals? Where do we even start? There's just so many options.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. That's, again, I guess the downside and upside of real estate. There's, a lot of options, but that can also be kind of confusing when you start. Again, I think you start with your end goal in mind. Again, are you looking to, kind of stop doing medicine at some point, or is this just more of a passive income sitting in the back? Again, like funds like mine, it's truly passive. There's nothing you have to do. You literally send us a check. We do all the work. We send you a check back with the return. So if that's more of your style or your interest where you don't want to really be involved at all, that's perfect. We have a lot of physicians that invest with us, not because I'm a physician, but just because it's perfect for them. They're super busy. They don't want to really even understand what's going on. They just want to know, hey, these guys are good. They know what they're doing. And they just invest with us. You can, like you said, start with single family homes, multifamily, commercial. That's where you're going to have to spend a little more time. You have to educate yourself, understand what the different options are, then pick which one you want. Typically, more smaller single families or small multifamilies are going to be easier. If you want to start with commercial, you can certainly do that, but that's going to be a little bit more complicated. The numbers are bigger, but again, the return is bigger. So really, I think you have to start with your end goal in mind, see where you really want to go with this, and then kind of work backwards and pick the best solution there.
How much startup capital does somebody need in order to get started? I mean, is it, do you need like $50,000 or $100,000 to even have any hope of breaking into this, or can you do it with smaller amounts like $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000?
My recommendation is about $50,000. That's what I always recommend, is if you don't have $50,000, kind of build that up some form or fashion, which if you're a physician, it shouldn't be too hard to get to that point. But, you know, anything under that is tough, because even if you're, first of all, like, for example, my fund is a $50,000 minimum. Most funds like mine are going to be 50 to up to even 250 minimum. Even if you want to go buy a house or single family or small multifamily, you're looking at 25% down. So even at $50,000, you're buying a $200,000 property. DC, that itself is almost difficult to even find anything at $200,000. The rest of the country, it certainly can be done. But once you get like $10,000, $20,000, it's just kind of hard to do much with that kind of money in real estate.
You know, one of the things that I think is challenging for folks is that as you're looking at different options for where you can put your money, you know, savings accounts, CDs, mm-hmm. the stock market, real estate, there's a lot of sort of vagary, a lot of nebulousness to real estate. You say real estate and people are like, okay, I like the idea of real estate, but I don't know what that means. But yeah. People talk about the stock market incessantly. It's on every scrolling feed on CNBC and CNN and MSNBC. So what would you say are some of the advantages of real estate over things like the stock market or other avenues?
Right. To me, it's a no-brainer. I mean, absolutely real estate, 100%, without question, no-brainer. So I think, again, the typical model is, you know, you work a job, whether it's medicine or something else, you have a 401k, you invest in your 401k, you work your career and you retire. That's the typical, you know, whatever model. The problem is it doesn't work. It's very difficult to build wealth that way. I did the same thing when I was in my 20s and, you know, started making an income. I was like, oh, okay, let me invest in my IRA or 401k. What do they tell me to do? It just didn't do much for me. So I think you have to think outside the box if you really want to build some wealth. Again, as a physician, you make good money, but I don't think you're wealthy, if that makes sense. You know, again, it's a good living and all that kind of stuff. So I think, yeah, you really have to look at real estate. So again, if you compare like, again, the completely passive, a fund like ours, we're going to pay you 15% per year. That's double probably what the stock market will do. And if you look at a compound over a 15 or 20 year period, the numbers are crazy how much more you would make. Now, if you want to get more actively involved and buy properties, you get significant advantages, right? You're getting cash flow, you're getting appreciation of the property, you're getting debt pay down, you're getting tax advantages. So to me, again, it's a no-brainer. Go to real estate over the stock market, or certainly cash. Cash is the worst. But again, it does take some time and effort to do this. So it's not like just, you know, completely that easy.
So how are you guys able to consistently beat the stock market with those kinds of returns? I mean, so the stock market, the S&P 500 historical average is between 7% and 8% year over year. Mm-hmm. And that's average. I mean, there's going to be some years that it's 30 up and there's going to be some years where it's 20 down. But 7% to 8% year on year is about right. So how are you guys able to consistently beat that by almost double?
We're doing development projects. So these projects make, you know, return on equity, 100%, 400% kind of returns is what we're looking at. I mean, these are real estate development projects where we're taking properties and we're in DC, typically we're adding density, we're adding square footage, we're doing luxury condos. That seems to be the typical thing we're doing. We have some single family homes as well. So the returns we get are really, really good for us as developers. So we're able to, because of that, afford to pay our investors 15%. There are funds out there that invest in real estate, like single tenant stuff, which is less return. So they pay their investors like 7% or 8%, which again is more comparable to the stock market. But because we're doing development, we're able to pay a much higher return.
Gotcha. Well, that all sounds really excellent, but we also know that with higher returns oftentimes comes higher risk. So what are some of the risks that we have with investing in some of these real estate ventures?
Again, I can't speak for other folks because I don't, you know, all my money is invested in my stuff. But I feel that I think we offer a really, really good low risk type of fund because, again, we're investing in a world class market, DC. Even during the 08 crash, I guess you can call it, DC proper is only down 4%, believe it or not. The suburbs of DC a little bit farther out were down about 30%, maybe up to 40%. But DC proper is only down 40%. So that's one of your biggest risks with development, right? You develop something, you perform it at this number, all of a sudden the market goes down significantly and it's worth half. That, you know, knock on wood, essentially doesn't happen in DC. There's such strong demand always. We've got a world-class market in terms of we've got this thing called the federal government. I don't know if you've heard of them, but good old Joe Biden's running the show right now, not probably about 15 minutes from here. And they just spend money like crazy. I mean, it's just unbelievable, ungodly amounts of money they spend. And when things are bad, they tend to spend more money, as you've just seen with coronavirus, which we're still coming out of. Our market, you know, last March when we went into the pandemic, I was, you know, pretty concerned, but we were actually up 10% last year. We had one of the best years we've ever had. I don't know if the entire country experienced that, but we did. And a lot of that was because the federal government just spent more money. I can keep going on and on, but we've got a ton of business coming into DC as well because it's kind of this government business partnerships are becoming more and more common. Amazon just, you know, their headquarters too just was announced about a year or two ago. But it's not just Amazon. We've got Microsoft, Oracle, every company you can think of is coming here. So it's really market risk. It's working with seasoned professionals like us. I've been doing this so long. So again, we know how to navigate DC. We know how to develop buildings. So when you look at all of those factors, that's what you have to consider when you're thinking of an investment. Who are you investing with? What market? What type of product are they delivering? What's their track record? If all of that is good, then your risk is very low, even though we can offer a very good return.
Well, how do you start to vet that? I mean, how do you know what kinds of questions to ask if you're a novice at this stuff?
Like I say, okay, first of all, who are the sponsors, right? Who's running the show? How long have they been doing it? What is their track record? Can you show me projects you've done exactly like you want me to invest in? And what are their financial results? What type of product are you building, right? Again, to me, a condo development is in DC is much less risky than something in, you know, I don't know, pick a Orlando, Florida or something. Florida tends to be a market that gets really hot sometimes, but also goes down a lot. So you just have to, those are the factors you have to ask and consider. And then, you know, again, like I say, historical performance of the fund itself, if the fund has been around for a while. But yeah, those are the very important questions to vet before you invest with anybody.
So let's think more national. So you mentioned the DC area. And so for places that don't have the federal government a stone's throw away, you know, dumping money like crazy, what percentage of the real estate ventures out there are going to be flops or total failures? Is it a fairly high percentage or does it just really vary from company to company and year to year?
I think it varies. I don't think doing it like a 10% fail kind of thing is really, because it really depends on who's running the show and what are they doing. I think real estate in general at a high level is less risky than a lot of things. Certainly if you're an angel investor and you're investing in startup companies, that the risk is super, super high, again, compared to real estate. Because in real estate, we're still buying an asset. There's still like an actual value to this asset. I was involved like with restaurants for a while, like about a year or two. That didn't go very well at all. And again, when you're buying a restaurant, assuming you're not buying the real estate, whatever you put in can go to like 5% of the value. Everything can go down because if the restaurant goes out of business, there's really no value left there. All the equipment and the furniture and things like that have essentially zero value. So in general, real estate tends to be less risky. But again, I think it's very important to vet who you're working with because, you know, there's plenty of people out there that'll take your money and still, you know, maybe not deliver what they promise.
You mentioned tax advantages a second ago. Can you walk us through what some of those tax advantages are for real estate?
Yeah, there's a number. I mean, again, I could talk forever about taxes, but the biggest one is depreciation. So a lot of times if you set up a rental property properly, whatever cash flow you're getting, that's your profit every month or year, you can offset that almost 100% with depreciation. So essentially that's kind of free money that you're not free money, but tax-free money you're getting until, of course, you sell the property. There's another thing, I don't know if you've heard about accelerated depreciation is still available. President Biden wants to get rid of this, which, you know, that's why you can maybe tell by the way I'm saying his name. I'm not a big fan, but he's trying to get rid of accelerated depreciation. So a lot of things we do is, for example, we just sold a 6-unit building. We made a fair amount of profit on it. We just closed it out about a month ago, and we've bought 3 or 4 properties that basically all the accelerated depreciation on those 3 or 4 are going to offset this profit. So we're going to have essentially a net zero tax on the profit. Other things you can do is a 1031 exchange, which is, again, he's trying to get rid of it, but it's still available right now. You have a property, it goes up in value, you get a bunch of equity into it or from it, and then you can exchange it tax-free for another property instead of having to pay tax. So there's a number of things you can do with real estate that can really lower your tax burden, essentially.
So that makes sense for single family properties or for individual real estate properties, but you're probably not going to be able to do that with a real estate fund or a real estate syndication or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's the one thing is that like if you invest in our fund, that is taxable money, the percent. You can invest in our fund. A lot of people do through a self-directed IRA. So you have money in your IRA, and then all the profit that's coming out of it goes right back into the IRA. So that's very, very popular. We have a number of people that do that. So that is one way to avoid paying the tax up front, at least. You can do it with a Roth IRA as well.
Can you walk us through the self-directed IRA a little bit? I think that this is a concept that I think probably a lot of people are not familiar with. So can you walk us through a little bit about what that means and how would we go about setting something like that up?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of like a hidden secret out there. I think I've been doing it for at least 10 years, probably more closer to 15 years myself. I've had a self-directed IRA, but when I first learned about it, I'm like, really? You can do this? because the idea is that the big companies, the Schwabs and Fidelities, don't want you to know about this because they want to keep your money with them because that's where they make their fees and that's their whole business model. And I actually still remember walking into a Schwab branch and asking the person there, like, do you have an IRA where I can invest in real estate directly or buy a company or buy a property? Like, oh, you can't do that in IRA. It's not possible. Obviously, they were wrong. So the idea with a self-directed IRA is that essentially you can invest in almost anything you want in your IRA. There are some limitations of collectibles, fine wine, art, things like that are disallowed, but very, very few things are. So you could actually buy a company in your IRA. You could buy shares of a company in your IRA, like an actual, like not a stock market company, but like a local company. You could buy a rental property in your IRA. You could invest in our fund with your IRA. They're very easy to set up. We work with Mid-Atlantic IRA. They're kind of a medium-sized company right here in Frederick. We do podcasts with them once a month. So if you want to check out my social media, we get into this in more detail of how to do this. But it's really easy to set up. You essentially just fill out the paperwork and the money goes from your regular IRA into a self-directed IRA. And then that money can be used essentially for almost anything you want to invest in.
So is that the kind of thing that you need certain licenses to be able to set that up or certain qualifications to be able to maintain? Or is that something that just any average Joe off the street can have something like that set up?
No, absolutely. Anybody. Yeah. I mean, there are certain companies that they're the custodians. So you have to go with a self-directed IRA company. Again, we use Mid-Atlantic. There's Equity Trust is another big one out of Ohio that I've used in the past. But as long as it's a self-directed IRA company, once the money is in that account, again, you as the you're not really the owner. You're the trustee or whatever the term is. They're the custodian, but then they are actually doing the investment for you into whatever you decide to invest in.
So let's say that we are thinking about a particular real estate venture, and maybe it's a let's take it from the idea that we're using a real estate investor company, a real estate developer company, and they bring us an opportunity and says, okay, for an investment of $25,000 or $50,000, you can have X number of shares in this luxury condo building that's going up outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm. How do we determine if that deal is going to be a good deal or not? Because we talked a little bit about vetting the company themselves, but let's say it's a company that has been recommended from a friend who's done deals with them in the past, and they feel like it's a pretty reputable thing. Or let's say we think it's a pretty reasonable company. But how do we vet a particular deal to know that this one has a high likelihood of success versus this one's pretty shaky?
Pretty shaky, yeah. The biggest number I would tell you to look at is what I call it return on cost. You can look at a return on investment. But look at what their total costs are on that project. So, like, let's say it's $1 million, right? That's acquisition, development, the finance, all their cost total on this project is going to be $1 million. You want to see a pretty high return on cost for the developer. So you want them to be making at least 20%, 30% return. I don't even touch a deal anymore unless it has a 20% return for us. And again, the people are like, well, why do I care what the developer is making? The reason is that's your insurance. So if I'm making a 30% return on my deal, almost everything would have to go wrong and even more before I would even get close to getting into a negative. And that, then if we get into a negative, that's where your equity would be at risk, what you put into the deal. If the developer is operating at like an 8 or 10% return, you know, it can get negative pretty quick. Just an example, when I was building new homes in Arlington, I don't really do that as much because of this reason. We were operating at like between 9 to maybe up to 15% returns. In DC, we're like 30 is almost my minimum. Now 20 is my absolute minimum, my hard minimum. So that's really why I prefer DC, because I've got a lot more cushion. Things could go wrong. We have delays. You know, we've got big issue. We've got issues right now with increasing prices of lumber and all the materials. Yet we're still fine. Our deals are completely fine, even though we're paying more for the materials. So really, that's what you want to really dive into, is what are they making and what's their margin? If they got a really fat margin, then you're safer as the investor compared to someone who's operating on a thin margin.
So how is someone going to know up front if they're, you know, what that return on cost is going to be? Because those are going to be estimates before the project gets started, right?
Yeah, that's again where, I mean, you have to dive into their financials a little bit, ask them for that information. But, you know, I'm not saying they would fudge it, but like you're saying, those are estimates. So they can kind of make it look really rosy. So maybe look at their historical deals and say, look, you just finished. Show me some deals you finished. Show me the actual numbers of what you've done or what you've experienced. That's what I'm saying. Like, if you're going to invest, I think you have to be, it's not just like blindly saying, you know, oh, whatever, here's 100 grand, go. Take a little time, investigate it, you know, look at the numbers, especially when you're first investing with somebody.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, I know you went and did this full time, but I've got to believe that most physicians are probably not going to go off and do this kind of thing. Full time is going to be more of a side thing for them. But how do you know when it's the right move for you to do full time? What would you need? What would need to be true in order for you to feel like going full time into real estate investing is the person's best move?
I mean, I think what do you enjoy, right? Do you enjoy this more than practicing medicine? If you really enjoy practicing medicine, I would continue doing that. Absolutely. We need good doctors too. We absolutely need that. To me, it was more, I had to replace my income because I had, you know, small children, I had a mortgage, you know, the wife's like, hey, you know, what are you doing over here? So once I was able to replace my income pretty, you know, safely, I was like, look, I don't need to work shifts anymore. And I can take all that time and energy and focus into real estate and build this thing even bigger. And my, you know, passion and dream is more to build a large, you know, real estate development company. So that's just what I want to do. And I think to me, it's like once I was financially able to let go of medicine, I haven't worked my last shift in October of 2009 and I've never stepped foot in an ER again.
So how do you feel like the real estate investment world has changed in the last 2 years? Because we've had tremendous upheaval in the country, right? So we had, you know, a huge economic shutdown, massive artificial recession, and now we're coming out of it and we're spending more money than we knew could be spent by God or man. So a lot of things are going on, right? So how have you seen the real estate marketing changing over the last couple of years here?
I think, I mean, obviously one of the biggest milestones or issues was COVID, which hit, what is it, like spring of last year, right? February, March, that's when it all kind of came to light that this is going to be a really big deal. What we've seen is, again, prices are up. I mean, that's really what we're seeing in the last 12 to even 18 months. We're experiencing at least 10% increases in our construction budgets, but we're also getting at least 10% more on the outsale. So net, we're actually making more money as developers because my project I just closed out, we had $1 million construction budget. So we spent about 1.1 in the project, but we had a $3 million out sale. So we got about $3.3 million out of the project. So we were net, if you net it out, we're actually making more. People are always asking, is this a bubble? Or are we, you know, market going to crash? All this kind of stuff. The answer is, I don't know. Nobody knows. And anybody who tells you they know, they don't really know either. I think the most important thing is just look at the deal and look at your strategy. Real estate is a long-term investment thing. And I think everyone gets hung up on what's going to happen this year, what happened last year. I've been doing this 20 years. I've seen great things. I've seen things go down. You just have to have a long-term philosophy of what are you doing with your real estate investments and just kind of stick to it, whether the market's up or the market's down, that type of thing.
So one of the financial adages that I like is don't have all your eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. And so if someone's got $100,000 in their nest egg and all of it's in one property and it mm-hmm. goes under, they lose everything. Mm-hmm. So do you have any recommendations for maybe a percentage of someone's portfolio that should be dedicated to real estate? Do you have some allocation that you like to keep in the stock market or other types of investments, or does it change as one's nest egg and portfolio grows?
Yeah, I think it depends on how much money you have, because if you have 50,000, it's hard to diversify to a, you know, large extent. Again, I'm still a big believer in real estate, so I'm diversified within real estate. I have like 3 or 4 different things I do in real estate. So I feel like I'm well diversified. But again, some people are like, no, I want to be in the stock market. I want to be in real estate. I want to be in gold, or, you know, whatever. It's really a personal preference. I wouldn't necessarily say, you have to put 10% here or 50% there, that type of thing. It's really what you're comfortable with. But understand, even within real estate, you can diversify. Just because you're in real estate doesn't mean that you have, you know, you're only in one thing.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I'm very interested to know what you see as diversification within real estate. You're talking about having a mix of single family homes versus real estate projects versus real estate syndications. Are you talking about, you know, condos versus homes, or what are we thinking about there?
I have probably development is my main thing. So there's, you know, DC development. So that's a significant portion of what I do. But I also have short-term rentals. So we're acquiring a portfolio of short-term rentals. We just opened an office in Florida. So we just purchased 3 just recently, and we're going to grow that. So to me, that's very diversified, because you've got development has completely different risk, you know, like reasons why it could go wrong versus the short-term rental market. I also have long-term rental assets that I hold as well in a different market. So I feel like those are diversified, even though they're technically all real estate. We also do education and some other things within real estate.
Do you think that it's helpful for someone to have either a property manager or some kind of asset manager when they're first getting started? Or is the cost benefit not there, and people just need to kind of learn how to do this on their own so that way they can keep all their money in their pockets?
Yeah. As far as property management, again, it's really up to you. You know, long-term managers, you know, typically around 9% is the number they're going to charge. So it's not a huge number. I've done it both ways. I've had properties in Northern Virginia where I self-managed them. I mean, literally, I did nothing. The tenants were so easy, never heard from them much. And it was, you know, very, very easy situation. I've had property managers in other properties where I felt like there was more like hands-on management of the tenants. You've got to understand that property managers, they're all just okay. So they're not going to just because you put the property with them, they're not going to 100% take it over. There's still issues that come up if there's not a foreclosure, but if there's an eviction. We've had issues with, like, they didn't pay my taxes 1 year. They were like, well, we're not supposed to pay your taxes. You're supposed to pay your taxes. I'm like, well, I didn't know that. You didn't really tell me. So just things like that, that you're still involved, but it just gives you one less, you know, you're another buffer between you and the day-to-day tenant management. So I don't necessarily have like a, you have to go one way or the other on that. It's really personal preference and maybe how much time and effort you think the tenants will take to manage.
Can you talk about what you think would be some of the big mistakes that you've seen people make when it comes to getting into real estate investing? Because I imagine that there's a lot of common mistakes that people make. I mean, we see this in medicine too, right? The kinds of diagnostic errors that people make, it's syndromic. I mean, the kinds of errors we see make, you know, your consultants will say like, oh man, here comes another one of these consults. I get these all the time. So
they're calling us out.
so what are some of the more common mistakes that people make, and just help us avoid some of those?
You know, not understanding that, again, like, what are you getting into, right? So again, if you're in a passive fund like ours, it truly is passive. We've had my business partner, Dan and Carrie, they have a huge real estate sales organization. They're actually by far the largest in DC, and they're actually like number 11 in the country. So they have a lot of people approach them and say, hey, we want to buy a rental property. We've heard it's good, all this kind of stuff. And when they actually sit down and explain to them the actual numbers, the amount of work it takes, a lot of them are like, I don't know if this is really what I want to do. And a lot of those actually tend to be physicians, believe it or not, because they think they've heard they got to be in real estate. So they want to buy some properties. Everyone tells them they should. Their buddy or whatever is doing it. So they approach the sales team. They're like, hey, I want to buy property. And then when they tell them the details are like, no. And then we actually tell them about our fund. They're like, oh, that sounds a lot better. So I think just not understanding what you're getting into and the amount of potential work there is involved. if you want, I think there's a lot of folks who are, whether physicians or not, want to do rehabs. Like that's how I started. They watch an episode of HGTV and they make it look so easy and they put all the little fancy numbers on the screen and they're like, wow, that's really easy. I can do that. But not understanding that, you know, there's a lot more that goes into it than what you see on HGTV. So again, it's a business. You have to learn it. It's not your first couple. You're probably going to, you know, screw up and maybe even lose money. But if you're committed to this for the long term, you'll eventually figure this out and do that. So I think those are probably the two things. You know, if you're thinking more passive, they think it's completely passive when it's not. But if they want to do something more active, they don't understand the scope of what's involved with it. And then they kind of end up getting to the negative and they're like, oh, my God, and they stop doing this.
If people want to learn more about how to do this well, I mean, there's an endless supply of resources and books and websites and various things. Do you have any resources that you like to recommend for folks if they're first starting out, they want to kind of learn the process and just familiarize themselves with some of how to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. Check out my social media. That's all I talk about on my TikTok and my Instagram. My handle is The Sunil Saxena on both of them. I have my top 100 books I recommend, as well as my top 50 real estate books I recommend. So if I'm an avid reader. So if you, I've written two books as well. So if you're interested in reading books, I think it's a great way to build your knowledge base. Check out all my book recommendations. Again, it depends on how much bandwidth you have and how much time and effort you really want to put into this. But I highly recommend attending conferences, you know, networking, just kind of getting to know your local real estate community. That's how I started. You know, those type of things. I think even paid education is good. We have programs that we're coming out with if you want to do paid education. So there's a ton of stuff you can do. It just depends on how much time and effort you really want to put into this thing.
Do you think for when people are starting out, it makes sense to start with investing in some kind of venture that's local? You know, they could drive by the site, they can kind of keep tabs on it, keep an eye on things and really understand the market better? Or is there just so much information out there nowadays about various ventures that it's fairly easy to vet a deal from a long distance away?
My personal opinion, I'm more of a local kind of guy. I really feel like that's why, you know, I want my real estate to be kind of where I can go and touch it and feel it. I don't think you have to do that, but my recommendation would be, yeah, if you can invest in something local, you get to know the people, the properties, the area. Just by living in an area, you kind of know, right, already, like, here's a good area, here's a bad area, what's going on. If you're investing in, you know, a city you've either never been to or you just visited for a weekend, you don't really know what's good and bad in that city. So again, my recommendation is local if you can.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Saxena, this has been really interesting. I think that you've given us a lot to think about, and hopefully this is going to start to demystify the idea of real estate investing and take real estate from being this sort of nebulous, vague term to maybe being something more tangible, more practical that people can actually start to dive into. If people want to connect to you and get more content or, you know, kind of continue the conversation, how can people connect to you?
Yeah, social media is the best way right now. I've got big on TikTok and Instagram. I've got a YouTube channel as well as Facebook. But all the handles are just my name. So it's The Sunil Saxena. You put that in any of them, my stuff should come up there.
Awesome. And we'll make sure we put all that in the show notes so that way people can find it really easily. Well, Dr. Saxena, this was a great discussion. I really appreciate you coming on. I want to encourage everyone, go connect to him on social media. We'll have all the links for that in the show notes. And, you know, if you want to learn more about real estate investing, I mean, he has literally written books on the subject. So you definitely got to go check it out. Well, he is Dr. Sunil Saxena. Dr. Saxena, I'm going to say thank you again so much for joining us on the Scope of Practice podcast today. We really appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Real estate is one of those things that seems a lot scarier than it actually is. And I hope that this conversation with Dr. Saxena gave you some pearls to help you feel like you're ready to take the first step towards getting into the real estate game, or to take the next big leap if you're already in the game. There are a lot of great opportunities out there, so keep an open mind. The tax code is so heavily slanted to favor real estate and business investment that it really makes sense to invest in real estate as part of your long-term financial strategy. And hey, listen, if you're looking for other ways to capitalize on new long-term financial strategy, or if you're looking for more resources about real estate, don't forget you can sign up for the Marriage and Money MD Summit for free. It's going to be November 15th through 17th, and you can sign up at www.marriageandmoneymd.com. Don't miss out on this amazing summit. It's free and it's full of amazing speakers and phenomenal content. Sign up today by clicking the links in the podcast description. Also, if you upgrade to the All Access VIP Pass today, you get lifetime access to the presentations, plus 10 hours of bonus content, a free online financial planning course to give you a concrete step-by-step plan for building wealth, MP3 files of all the talks, and exclusive access to attend the live Q&A sessions after the summit presentations each night. Tickets are $99 until November 14th, so take advantage of great savings and upgrade now. Just click the link in the podcast description to register. Thanks so much for joining me on the Scope of Practice podcast today. You can also find all those resources in the show notes at www.thescopeofpractice.com/episode83. That's www.thescopeofpractice.com/episode83, or just click the links in the podcast description. Thanks so much for joining me, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Scope of Practice podcast at www.thescopeofpractice.com.